accession number 20364, reel 1.
Mr. Cheeseman, reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Dorking.
Which year was this?
1933.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Dorking?
I did, yes. I was educated at St. Paul's School, and then I went to Radio Technical College, leaving there. Not very successful, I must add.
How old were you when you left the tech?
16.
So that would be 49?
That's right, 49.
So you spent all the Second World War years in Dorking?
I did, yes. All of the war in a cottage in South Street.
What was it like being a schoolboy in Dorking in the Second World War?
Fun. You know, we weren't old enough to be fearful, I think. And, of course, we used to get out on our bikes and ride around to several German planes that were brought down around here, trying to get the perspex and goodness knows what else to make rings and brooches and anything else. And all a bit of an adventure, we thought, really.
Why did you want to make rings and brooches?
Just as souvenirs, I suppose. We used to try to get stuff from the cockpits, but of course the military always used to arrive fairly quick and chase us off. But we managed to get a few bits. And lots of things then. You know, I remember my father making cigarette lighters out of cannon shells and things like that, if we could get hold of them.
Were the rings and brooches for girls or something?
Yeah, to give to girls. You didn't see many mothers wearing them. I think they were too crude, but of course we thought they were great.
Did you see any bodies?
No, not any bodies close. Saw one German from a distance who was in a tree at Westcott. A bomber crashed and his body had obviously been thrown from the plane and was hanging in a tree, but it was covered or partially covered, and of course the military moved it away as quick as possible.
Did you see any German captives?
Not in the early stages of their capture. There were a few prison camps around here, and used to see some being transported to work and things like that. But
did any bombs fall in Dorking?
Bombs, yes. We had a stick of bombs right across the town, which caused damage without casualties. One of which fell reasonably close to where I was. It blew me out of bed, in fact. But then we had bombs struck an estate called Fraser Gardens on the north end of Dorking. There were several killed and injured. And another stick of bombs landed on Watson Road in Westcott, and I believe five or six people were killed with quite a lot injured. After that, we had one or two places struck by doodlebugs, more towards the end of the war. But for a small market town, it saw quite a bit of action.
Where did the doodlebugs hit?
One excuse me, one struck a cottage along Westcote Road. That killed a young baby. Another one struck a big house in Tower Hill in Dorking. I don't think that actually killed anybody, but caused quite a lot of damage. And most of the others around this area fell harmlessly. They landed in woods and fields. Didn't claim any life that I know of.
Did they create any sense of terror?
I would say they were the most frightening. Again, as kids, if we were out, you could hear them coming, and you used to wait for the engine to stop. And that was when it was most fearful, I think, not knowing where it was going to land. But once we heard the bang, we were on our bikes again and off in the general direction, trying to track it down, one or two of which we did. But the military were always very quickly on the spot and used to put a couple of sentries on. And sometimes the sentries were nice blokes and they'd let you sneak a few little bits of souvenirs and before they told you to clear off, which we felt was quite an achievement, you know, comparing bits. But we actually got to one so quick that one of my mates picked up a piece of it and it was red hot. He got his fingers burnt in more ways than one because it was taken away from him when the military arrived.
And what was your address in Dorking in the war?
1 South Street Cottages, Dorking.
Was that cottage damaged?
No, no.
Were you injured when you were blown out of bed?
No. Just frightened and annoyed, I think.
What happened on that occasion?
Well, the plane just discarded the bombs, and one landed on a road called Marlborough Hill, one landed on Marlborough Road, the next one landed behind a printing press in South Street and done quite a bit of damage, and the next one landed in the sand pits at Vincent Lane. So they fell in a straight line, 3 of them amongst property, but nobody killed.
Any celebrations at the end of the war?
Oh yes, yes. VE Day, especially, I remember as a boy in South Street, everybody dancing and singing and the band playing in the bandstand, which we had in Dorking then. And yeah, wonderful.
Any vandalism?
No, not to my knowledge. No, never suffered with that problem then.
Were there any troops around in Dorking during the war?
Oh, a lot, yes. We had troops stationed in Dorking in various places. First English, then mainly Canadian. And all around the outlying districts, big houses were taken over by troops. And several places in the woodland, they put up Nissen huts and created camps, as I say, mainly Canadian towards the end of the war.
How did the troops behave?
Usually very, very well. The only problems were sometimes weekends when they came together in the pubs and used to have a few fights. But in general, they were nice people, and they were good to the people of Dorking as well.
In what sense?
Well, I used to, you know, we used to have one or two of them pop round to my folks, and they'd bring you little treats, because they'd have food parcels from Canada and things like that. So there'd often be little treats they'd bring round in the shape of sweets and biscuits, cake, that sort of thing.
Now, how did you come to be in the army yourself, please?
I was called up in August as a national serviceman and went to Stoughton Barracks at Guildford in the Queen's Regiment. Did my initial 6 weeks training there. Then went to Germany, to Iserlohn, joined the 1st Battalion.
How did you get on in the training at Guildford?
Very, very difficult. I suppose it helped, having come through the war and not being used to having much, but it was quite a shock to the system, going in as a national serviceman. All we had to do to learn, you were chased and harried. It was very, very hard, especially for some. Some found it more difficult than others. I was fortunate, I was a fairly quick learner. I'd been in the Army Cadets, which helped, I think. And I was strong physically. But there were a few who genuinely suffered. It was extremely difficult, in my opinion.
Were there some who were just rejected as impossible as soldiers?
Yeah, the Army, as you had a wonderful system. They could separate the wheat from the chaff, so to speak. And there was always a niche for somebody. And once you got through your initial training, they seemed to find a slot for all the individuals. Those that weren't quite up to it made their way to headquarter company or something like that. They were very good at finding a slot for people. And of course, also, I think in those days, you build up a comradeship and nobody looked down on anybody else. Either you could do things or you couldn't do things, and that was accepted.
So nobody was persecuted?
No, I never saw any persecution, no.
What happened to you at Iserlohn?
Well, I was with the 1st Battalion till just after Christmas, and then I volunteered for transfer to the Royal Fusiliers, who were just across the other side of Iserlohn. And we knew they were on the move. The rumour then was that it was Hong Kong. But a load of us transferred across and joined.
Why did you want to transfer?
I wasn't in love with the Queens. It was bull, bull and more bull. And the regulations seemed to be a bit severe. And there were a lot of us that felt a bit discontented, and when asked to volunteer for the Royal Fusiliers, we stepped forward as a man. And I think also it was the thought of going to the Far East and that sort of thing at our young age. I mean, I don't think any of us had ever been outside of England before getting posted to Germany.
How did you know the bull wouldn't be just as bad in the Royal Fusiliers?
Well, we used to meet up with them in town, and of course there was all the rivalry, as usual, between the two regiments. But I also knew a fella from Dorking that was in the Royal Fusiliers. And he used to get quite a bit of chat about, oh, we don't have to do that, we don't have to do that. And, you know, anyway, I never regretted joining the Royal Fusiliers. I loved the regiment. We were treated, I think, more in a more adult manner. It sounds as if I'm having a real downer on the Queen's Regiment, which I'm not, because events later on led to me going into the Queen's TA, which I did long service, and I was a Sergeant Major in the 5th Battalion. But that's a different story. Going back to joining the Fusiliers, we were known as the Swedes, coming from outside London, but it turned out in the finish that when we came back for training, there were more Swedes than there were Londoners, because we had fellas drafted in from the Sussex, Northamptonshires, East Surreys, and quite a few other regiments. So, yeah, the Swedes were taking over.
What happened next?
Well, we got back to England, did training. By this time, it had been announced that we were going to Korea. And we trained, we were stationed in Brentwood in Essex, and then went away for, I believe, 3 weeks training in Norfolk at Thetford and on the military ranges. I missed out on quite a lot of that. I went down with double pneumonia and was put into Colchester Military Hospital. So I missed a lot of the training at Thetford. Then we had embarkation leave, and finally on the 26th of June 1952, we sailed from Liverpool for Korea.
What was the voyage like?
Quite good, actually. We did have one spell where we ran into in the Indian Ocean, terrible storm got up. They battened everything down, and the ship's captain announced over the tannoy that he was going to try to run round the edge of the typhoon. And if that was the edge that we were going round, thank God we weren't in the middle. It got extremely rough, high seas sometimes on the troop ship. It was like being in the bottom of a basin, surrounded by water. Indescribable, really. But I understand that there was over 2,000 personnel on the ship, troops and crew, and all bar a couple of hundred were seasick. It was not very pleasant on there at the time, but yeah, otherwise the journey, stopping at places like Aden, Singapore, Hong Kong, Colombo, you know, things we'd only heard of. We never dreamt that we'd go ashore at places like that. Fantastic. And we went eventually, 6 weeks after leaving, we arrived at Pusan in Korea.
What happened there?
First memories are that the American Negro Band suddenly appeared from behind this warehouse and marched down, playing a regimental march in a very groovy manner. And I can remember looking up and seeing our CO, Colonel Stevens, throwing his berry down and stamping his feet in disgust, whilst all us fellas were on the troop ship cheering our heads off, because they were good, they were fantastic. And in fact, they were the band that did a recording of the St. Louis Blues March.
What is your regimental march?
No,
what is your regimental?
They did that at our march as the British Grenadiers, which they hotted up and more or less jived to in formation. But they were terrific. I think it was a compliment that backfired.
What impression did you get of Korea?
Well, we were soon shipped off and put on a train. An old, well, cowboy style train, the best I can describe it. Wooden seats. And of course we had to have sentries, and we sat on the steps as sentries, and I found it so enthralling driving through, seeing how barren the country was, and then seeing tanks and all sorts of military vehicles as you looked out that had been destroyed in the push down and the push back. And the not seeing any, hardly any towns or villages, just paddy fields and mountains. But I think I ended up volunteering, and I sat on the steps for three shifts. I did my 2 hours, and then told the fella that relieved me, excuse me, that I'd do his as well. And then when the next chap turned up, I did his as well. I was so enthralled by it, and I think also I was a bit more comfortable on those steps than some of the lads were inside, with all the wooden benches and not a lot of room.
And then?
Well, then we arrived at transit camp. The King's Own Scottish Borderers had just moved out, having broken the drink record for the camp. And we moved in, because we relieved them in Korea. And we spent a few days there.
What do you mean, the drink record for the camp?
Well, it seemed that each unit that was returning back to England or leaving Korea to go to this camp, and they kept a record of how much beer they drank. And the King's Own Scottish Borderers evidently had no difficulty at all in beating the previous record. And I don't think we got anywhere near their record before we moved on. But then we went up country, and we were deployed into the mountains in companies for further training. But we were there, and we could hear activity from the front line. We could hear the artillery exchanges, and whenever flares went up, we could see them. Oh, it was our first taste, really, of anything going on. And always remember that wherever you were there, you could look up and see a searchlight that was trained from our positions onto a Chinese position, which we later served under. And it was near a hill called 355, which we held, but it was connected by a ridge to a group of four hills, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, which were held by the Chinese. And John, which was on the ridge that went across to 355, also stood right over a position that we used to man. It was always manned by, well, in the main by Commonwealth Division troops. And the searchlight was put on to this Chinese hill to restrict their movement, to stop them either getting down at our fellas or along the ridge to 355. They still did do it a couple of times, but they always went back after a bit of a punch-up. But they were our first visual signs of anything. And then from there, we were ordered to go in onto a position in the Samishon Valley. And I, with another one of our fellas, was sent up in advance to the Australians, who we were relieving. And I spent 3 days with the Australians.
What was that like?
I beg your pardon?
What was that like?
Quite eye-opening. No bull at all with the Australians. As a matter of fact, when I got up there with my mate, we went through and we were introduced to an Australian captain. And I remember now, we did the English thing and snapped to attention and threw him up a salute. And the first words I heard was, "You don't want to bloody do that, mate, you'll make him big-headed." And this was the way they were, even with their officers. And they never called him sir, they called him governor, if they showed him any respect at all. But they were good. They were a good fighting unit. And although they didn't appear to treat their officers with respect, I think in reality they did, because they did as they were told. And I was quite impressed by them.
What did they teach you in that short time?
Well, basically, I was there to learn about the position and for guiding our fellas in when they came. The land in front, they made you aware of it, gave you the nicknames of the enemy positions and the hill numbers, just that sort of thing, really. And
did they give you any warnings about what to do and what not to do?
No, not a lot. I think, again, the Aussies had their way of doing things. I mean, the difference between an Aussie fighting patrol and an English fighting patrol was that the Aussies went out with a case of beer, especially if they were doing ambush. They would even... I remember on one occasion seeing him go out and a fellow had a mouth organ. And one of the Australians I was talking to, I said, "What's the idea of that there?" I said, "A case of beer?" He said, "Yeah," he said, "they're going out on an ambush." And he showed me where they were going. And he said, "They take that to make sure that the chinks know they're there, because they want a bluey." So they weren't like us. We used to get to a place and get in, conceal ourselves and lay up quiet. But the Australian announced that they were there, inviting them to come and have a bluey, as they called it.
What's a bluey?
Well, a battle, a punch-up, you know, a general hoo-ah. And that's the way they were. They loved to fight. And the Chinese called them the men with the big hat and the long knife, because they refused to give up their long bayonets. The They always use their long bayonets, the Australians.
But wouldn't...